Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the JewelCast. Nick, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. All right. We are on. Welcome, everyone. How you doing, Nick? Nick, you there?
Yeah, hang on just one sec. I think I'm good now.
Okay, awesome. So, JewelCast. Yeah, we did it.
JewelCast. We made it on time. Only 10 minutes late this time.
Only 10. Better than the first episode. Yeah.
It's not bad.
And more importantly, before our guest is set to arrive. So, you know, that was the important.
He's actually, like, ready. Like, he's, like, chomping at the bit, I think. just real quick, we are going to have Derek from Fear of the Fin. Not from Fear of the Fin anymore. He went to Blogger Heaven with Robert P. and all the others that have passed on in the blogging world. But he's back for the playoffs. He didn't want to miss a chance to troll the Kings or the Ducks. He used to be the neutral. He used to be Fear the Fin on Twitter. Now he goes by It Was 3-0, which was
appropriate.
Pretty much the best name that could be taken if you're a Sharks fan. Or I guess the worst. I don't know. I'm upset that we didn't just change the Jewels from the Crown Twitter handle to that, to be honest.
He's a little bit of a self-hating in that respect, but that is, I think, very respectable. And he came back on the day of a Kings-Ducks matchup, which I think really just sort of sums it up. You may know his work from Thanks Bud's Selke campaign poster for Andrei Kopitar. That was eventually retweeted by the Kings official account, so...
He was definitely a temporary Kings fan. Like back before everything fell apart in 2014, he was like, I respect the Kings. I'm here for it. Like I think that was kind of a mutual thing, the Kings and the Sharks. Like we had the rivalry, but it was like, you know what? If the Kings aren't in it, I'll root for the Sharks. And if the Sharks were, you know, if they were out and the Kings were still in, it was like it wasn't the worst outcome in the world. It was a very like healthy, respectful rivalry. And then 2014 happened, and now all bets are off. Like there's hair flying, there's claws everywhere, there's just teeth bared. It's gritty now.
it's hate in every single direction, which I think has been really good for the rivalry as a whole, but maybe not for the health of various California hockey fans. And last year the Ducks got the upper hand, but they couldn't really rub it in as much as they wanted to because they ran into Chicago. So this is going to be a big year. The third time. That all three California teams have been in the playoffs at the same time.
Another true battle of California, much like 2014. I'm not sure what to expect from it this year.
Yeah, and I'm interested to get Derek's perspective on that as well. The brackets are starting to be filled out. I've noticed a lot of people, at least a lot of the people I follow, going with San Jose, maybe from sort of a change of pace standpoint. I don't know if it's truly that they think the Sharks are going to win the series, but it's even enough that I think they can get away with it.
I'm going to go back to 2014. I think every blogger picked the Sharks. I think they were tired of the Kings. I think the Sharks were like the sexy pick. It's like they've choked and they've, you know, they've struggled in the playoffs, but it's their time. And it was like a full party on Twitter when it was 3-0, which made that even sweeter. Like I remember one of the big guys behind it was Kemi from Pension Plan Puppets at the time. And I was very happy that things went poorly for them.
Yeah. And I think it all sort of, it built up and it didn't, you know, it didn't really get to get released. So last year when the Kings were eliminated, you saw that, that party sort of return.
Oh yeah.
In
which prompted
a big way.
Which prompted me to make a banner called the 2015 or 14-15 San Jose Sharks watch the Kings miss the playoffs. That was their new banner for the HP Pavilion.
Yep. And in fairness to San Jose, that was not a Sharks fan party. That was an everybody party. You know, much in the way that I think if Chicago gets eliminated in the first round this year, we'll see something similar. LA, probably the same, maybe not with that kind of intensity. But that's one of the many things we have to look forward to in the playoffs. We were going to discuss what went wrong last week before we got into our, you know, talking about the playoffs, but, you know, it's 7:15. I don't think there's any point. we blew a lead to Winnipeg. We lost in a shootout. There are no more shootouts. So we're going to pretend that we're completely over that and we're ready to face the Sharks. And we are ready. You're not over it.
No, it was excruciating. That was the most excruciating way to lose the division. That was the worst way. They were up 3-0 with 30 minutes to go, with 23 minutes to go in the season, and they lost the game in a shootout. And just the most frustrating way possible on a borderline, probably phantom penalty call in overtime to at least keep things away from 3-on-3, which the Kings have, by luck or not, excelled at this season, to get to a shootout, which is... just, it was probably the most appropriate way for the season to end, but it was also the worst way for the season to end, and I'm very glad to play out here.
Against Andrei Pavlovich, like that's, yeah. Now I'm getting mad about it, so we're not going to talk about it. We're going to instead note the irony that we were up 3-0 and lost and get to our guest. It was 3-0. So we're putting him on. Derek, you're on the air. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I mean, thanks for having me on a day that will live in infamy as GIF 9/11 on hockey Twitter. We're all very sad and mourning the death of the GIFs.
Oh yes, the GIFs. Rest in peace, GIFs. Nobody will ever make them again now. The GIFs are dead forever.
Yeah, there's no point in watching hockey. I don't know why we're even discussing the playoffs. There's no more,
like,
there's no more GIFs to view it through.
I canceled my cable subscription, and I just watched the games through GIFs on Twitter, actually, and now I can't do that.
That's the only way to watch. Yeah, it's the only way to watch them.
Did you watch a lot of hockey this season?
I unfortunately did. I watched probably about 80-85% of the Sharks games and a smattering of other games, mainly Blackhawks, unfortunately. But I saw enough hockey this year, I think.
So hockey does still exist if Twitter's not here too? Like if there's no Twitter, there's no
GIFs,
there's still hockey?
Unfortunately, I was hoping that'd be the trick. If I just logged off, all the hockey would go away, but no, it's not how it works.
So how did you feel about the Sharks' regular season? Are you happy, upset, okay with things?
Yeah, I mean, I think once they got Logan Couture back from injury, they looked like a much different team. They're three lines deep again, which I think was the key in 2013-14. And, I mean, it was even the key in that series against the Kings when they were rolling with Pavelski on the third line. They were doing pretty well for themselves, and then McClellan inexplicably switched things up, and things went south from there. That wasn't the only reason, obviously. But the Sharks have more depth this year than I think they certainly had last year and that they've had over the course of the Thornton era. Their defense is a little better. And obviously they added James Reimer at the trade deadline and now have two, maybe not elite or great goalies, but two serviceable starters at any rate.
And Martin Jones is going to be the number one to start the series at least?
Yeah, it looks like he's going to be the starter in game one. I think, or at least I hope, that Peter DeBoer won't be shy in going to Reimer if things don't work out with Jones. But, I mean, Martin Jones does have those seven saves of cup-winning experience in 2014. So
that's true. Very, very vital, very vital. He did. He also, I'm sure, just extremely valuable experience riding the bench for the next 24 games or whatever it was after that, too.
Yeah, best way to learn.
He got to watch the best, Jonathan Quick, the absolute best goalie in the NHL.
This is true.
Unless
he's
an
elite. Jonathan
Quick
is elite, and Martin Jones, by association, is an elite backup, I think.
He was a great backup. Like, actually, I will say, of all the backups we had, whether it be Jonathan Bernier or Ben Scrivens, who may as well be dead to Daryl Sutter, Martin Jones is the one he calls back to. He will call back to Martin Jones. Like, Jones really played well. Joner was good for us. Do you still call him Joner in San Jose? This is extremely important. Is he still Joner?
I'm ashamed that I've never called him Joner at this point. Yeah, he should definitely. I don't think anyone calls him that, but he should definitely be Joner.
I'll call him that. I'll call him Joner.
Yeah, I've got a raging Joner just thinking about the series right now.
We all do.
And he was weirdly bad last year, Martin Jones. But I mean, everybody kind of was on the Kings. He only played 15 games, so it's been kind of interesting from afar watching him. And he finishes with the exact same save percentage, 918 for the season, as Jonathan Quick had. So the debate may never really be settled.
Actually, it's
it
going to
settled
be settled
in this
series. Yeah, forever,
yes.
Definitively with this series. Is Jonathan Quick elite, or is he actually bad? It depends on if he gets beat by Martin Jones.
Agreed.
I mean, if Quick gives up 13 goals in the first two games again, then we might go a long way in determining that. But I'm going to put it out there that it's not going to happen again. It's a Mark Messier guarantee, and if it does happen again, then, you know, I'll retire.
I blame you. I will blame you.
Yeah.
I will blame you personally. I will go to L.A. and blame you.
As part of my preparation for this series, I was watching highlights of Game 2 from 2014 on YouTube today, and I can't believe that even happened. Like, it doesn't even feel real. Like, Mike Brown is scoring, Rafi Torres is scoring. Like, these people aren't even alive anymore. I don't know how that game happened.
Yeah,
that series is just bizarre.
They scored the first two in that game, right? The Kings.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like Jake Muzzin and Trevor Lewis score, and then the Sharks roll back with their fourth line leading the way.
See, here's a fun fact. Like you said, that Rafi Torres and Mike Brown are dead. Trevor Lewis is also dead, but he's still on our roster. It's really cool.
You can't be dead if you win the Unsung Hero Award 16 years in a row.
That's just because he literally can't sing because he's dead.
Is he? He's
That's
in hockey player heaven.
He's wow. You know, he doesn't get pie in hockey player heaven. That's only for bloggers. That's only for Robert P's friends.
My favorite Trevor Lewis thing is that I forget what offseason it was. I think Rudy Kelly wrote about this on Ballot California. But the Kings had like this fan cruise where they usually had like three players go on it. And the three players were supposed to be Wayne Simmonds, Drew Doughty, and Trevor Lewis. And then Simmonds was in a contract holdout, and Doughty was injured, so it was just Trevor Lewis alone on the cruise.
I hope he managed to actually score on that cruise. It's with those probably doesn't go well for him otherwise.
With the Kings fans.
I don't know, Derek. If you could have three Sharks players on a cruise, who would you choose and why?
Oh, God. That's a great question. I mean, I have to pick Hurdle because he's my large adult son. and I think we might as well just round it out with Tom, Dick, and Harry. I mean, Hurdle, Thornton, and Brent Burns. I mean, they were such a good line together. I gotta bring them on the cruise.
You wouldn't take creepy Logan Couture, or would you just be worried that he talked about his mom the whole time?
He way through the wood of the cruise. With those massive chompers. And I feel like Patrick Marleau would, like, try to swim in the ocean.
He would use his Ted Cruz eyes to just frighten the entire crew.
And he absolutely wears those floaties, right?
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I was picturing, just him in one of those flotation things.
He doesn't even go in the water. He just wears the floaties around the cruise, around the ship, just in case. He's just always prepared. I want to go back to John Quick real quick, and he really can't win in this series because even if like Jones gets pulled and they go to Reimer, then if he loses, he loses to the guy that wasn't good enough to succeed Bernier, who has been terrible in Toronto. He can't win.
It has to be a sweep with two shutouts, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the odds that we see Jonas Enroth at some point?
Slim.
No, you don't think Quick even gets pulled?
Unless the first two games happen again, like they did in 14, but no, I can't see it. He's played pretty well this year. I know the numbers don't bear it out lately, but visually he hasn't looked as good to me lately. He's been a little too aggressive for my taste, which is something I think he had kind of ironed out for a lot of this season. I hope he doesn't have the same problems he had lately. Like, he just looked shaky to me in the Winnipeg game. He looked kind of shaky here and there down the stretch. I'm hoping it was a focus thing because I think the Kings generally really genuinely do have a problem focusing when the games aren't as critical, and I think that was something that may have plagued them last season, and I think it did. I mean, after they clinched, they didn't look like they were the same team all of a sudden, and I think that's fair. They had a chance to take a mental break after what was a real stressful last season probably for them, and then this season trying to prove that they weren't that team, so they got a chance to relax, and it seemed like they took it on the ice because they looked like a different team in the Anaheim game too when it actually mattered, and it's like, oh, this game is for the division, and then they won the division and then lost the division to the Jets. It was typical.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I don't know. I think there are concerns with particular players, but as a team, I don't think there's anything to really harp on aside from maybe, well, at this point, the Alec Martinez situation has gone from innocent and maybe even a silver lining so he could get some rest to a little bit terrifying because Martinez, in terms of possession, his year hasn't been outstanding, but he's been getting the toughest assignments, and it's been really noticeable with him out. Number one, Jake Muzzin struggles, but also with different players sort of getting thrust into his role. And I think he'll be back for game one. My heart says he'll be back for game one. But if he's out, I think there's a lot of cause for concern.
I think there's a
little bit. That's why the Kings went out and got the piece with the deadline
to replace
Martinez.
He's gonna chip in on the power play. He's going to chip in on the power play. He's going to, be the second. He's going to be the quarterback on the second unit, and the Kings are going to lose in four games.
I was watching the end of that Kings Ducks game when they had him on the ice defending a one goal lead, and I was thinking, wow, I am really scared of the Los Angeles Kings.
He had a real bad career. I think he's just not been very good. Honestly, he was acceptable for 3 years probably, where he was decent. And as soon as the physical tools slipped a little bit, he can't push up on guys. His gap control is not any good. He has his reads as a King. Just watching him, I don't see the right reads personally. I see him on the wrong guy or missing his coverage or just not pressing up on his guy enough to where there's just a huge gap where there's a lot of soft space on the ice where they can be passed into. And it's frustrating to watch a defensive defenseman not play defense. Like,
it was kind of fun the first couple games seeing his insistence on banking the puck off the wall behind the net to Drew Doughty, and Doughty just sort of looking really confused every single time Scuderi did it and having to race back. And now the humor is gone a little bit.
I specifically remember Doughty making a cross ice pass to Scuderi, and I was wondering, like, if halfway across the ice, when Doughty passed it, he was just, like, regretting it. Like, why did I do that? Like, I should have just, like, literally ate the puck instead of passing it to Rob Scuderi. Just pick it up and shove it in my mouth and eat it. That's probably a better option.
A new meaning to eat the puck.
It's probably, like, the healthiest meal Doughty's had in weeks, too.
It's probably true.
So, go ahead, Nick.
No, I've got nothing. I just want to agree that Drew Doughty looks like he eats garbage.
I thought it was going to be really important really, really important.
Everything I say is really important. I think it's really important that we note that Drew Doughty looks like he goes to McDonald's, but not to buy like a Big Mac, just to raid the dumpster and eat the cardboard.
Mm-hmm.
He eats the carton on the Big Mac. He doesn't eat the Big Mac, which is already unhealthy. He just gets the grease from the Big Mac, and he just shoves it right in his mouth, and then he goes on the ice and plays for 30 minutes.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, you'd think that wouldn't be a sustainable diet, but whatever works, I guess. So Derek, on that note, what are you – I mean, you mentioned that the season was more or less acceptable for the Sharks. Are you concerned about – I guess for starters, we talked about Martinez's health. Is Vlasic's health something you're worried about at this point?
You know, I think they were probably overly cautious with him at the end of the season. I think maybe he could have gotten into one or two games before the end of the regular season, and they just chose to hold him out because there was literally nothing to play for the Sharks. They were locked into the 3 seed. So I would think slash hope that he's close to healthy or as healthy as any NHL player is in April for game one. But, I mean, yeah, there's always a lingering concern that Jarrett Stoll's going to pop out of the ice and slam his head into the glass, I guess. But, I'm definitely not still bitter about that series, by the way. But, yeah, I think Vlasic is probably pretty close to as healthy as he's going to be at this point.
Now, just real quickly on that note, does it concern you as a Sharks fan that the only time you beat them in a series was when Anje Kopitar was out of the lineup and the Kings didn't have Jeff Carter or Tyler Toffoli or Jake Muzzin? Does that concern you a little bit?
Well, I mean, they had to go up against the juggernaut that was first-line center Michael Hansen. So I think if you go to battle with that team and win, you can beat any iteration of the Kings.
He did beat the Kings in Game 6 of the Western Conference Finals in 2014, just to be clear, long after the Sharks were eliminated by the Kings. Michael Hansen was still alive.
Didn't he score like an overtime goal in that?
It was an overtime
series?
Goal. He tied the series, I think, to send it back. Or no, he made the series 3-2 to send it back to L.A. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. And it was amazing because the first overtime of that was what – most neutral observers have called probably the best period of hockey of that year and maybe in recent memory, just back and forth and back and forth. And the pace was unbelievable. And then it gets to double overtime and the slowest guy on the ice wins it. It just,
well, see, the thing was,
I don't know.
The Blackhawks finally capitalized on the fact that nobody on the ice thought that Michael Hontzius was a threat and they weren't covering him. And he just skated like it was like in D zone coverage. Hontzius skated right down the middle of the ice for a breakaway while the Kings were in their own end. It was ridiculous. It was the most absurd play. He suddenly, like, out of nowhere, had a breakaway right in front of Jonathan Quick on a pass from the corner or something like that. I don't remember the exact play, but it was something stupid. And then he scored, and the series was horrifying after that, but we survived.
And I think there's the main refrain that I've heard in contrast to that is the whole 2014 Vlasic being out. So if he returns, I think the Sharks defense is already sort of has a leg up on LA's defense. If Martinez comes back, it's more even, but we're very quickly tracking towards LA playing 4 guys, maybe 5 guys. I guess they'll give Luke Shen 20 minutes, but having, thankfully, Rob Scuderi not play 20 minutes, but having a 5 defenseman rotation with Drew Doughty and Jake Muzzin playing 28 to 30 minutes and Martinez playing his 25. And I think it's sustainable or more sustainable than you would expect, but it's a concern if Muzzin doesn't round back into form.
It is, and it's a concern if Luke Shen also gets a lot of minutes. Like, they should just go to 4 guys. Because Luke Shen has been brutal lately. He's had the same problems that Scuderi's had, except it's more frustrating because Shen is young and in his prime. He can't blame it on losing a step. He's just bad.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm thinking of comparables from the Sharks. And Derek, Roman Polak. Just talk about Roman Polak.
Yeah, he's not great. He's not great. I don't know if he's... I don't think he's quite as bad as Scuderi or even Luke Shen, although I haven't seen much of Shen this year. Maybe he'd magically figure out how to play hockey. But I don't know. Pollock has been better than I expected. He's certainly a much better skater than the sorts of one-dimensional defensive defensemen we're used to in San Jose, like the Douglas Murrays and the Nicholas Wallians. I think he's more in the echelon of Brad Stewart, which isn't great, but the difference is that Brad Stewart was playing top 4 minutes for the Sharks and really first pairing minutes in that King series after Vlasic went down. Whereas Pollock is he's never going to surpass Brent Burns or Justin Braun on the depth chart on the right side. So I think he's playing in a role that's more or less suited for him, but at the same time, if he's on the ice against Kopitar, Toffoli, or Jeff Carter, look out, because although he's faster than I thought he'd be, and although he's probably more mobile and better suited to playing the puck than I thought he'd be, he still has his issues in the defensive zone, and I don't entirely trust his skating against someone like Jeff Carter.
I do, personally, I do.
And yeah, I think I might be a little bit more optimistic on the Luke Shen front than Nick is, but I also did not watch the Winnipeg game, so I think they can get away with him in a smaller role. And I think on the penalty kill, he's better than Scuderi. I think he's, you know, they acquired him to be Matt Green, and he's pretty much been Matt Green without maybe Green sort of surprising possession success.
I think Green was a really good bottom third defender. The Kings have really missed this year, and it's why they went out and got both Scuderi and Shen, and they still are missing Matt Green. Which is sad, because Matt Green's not like the greatest player in the world, but he was a useful depth player. He was in a situation that worked for him, and that the Kings made work. And they have missed having at least a reliable guy on the third pairing that eats up 15 minutes of penalty 15 minutes of ice time with some penalty kill thrown in there.
Yeah, I mean I would take Green over Shen without a doubt at this point, but I do think, and I don't know, I think if, you know, Green was skating with both Martinez and Marian Gaborik at practice, I don't think we see Green again this year. I just don't think you can return from what amounts to a full year off with any sort of effectiveness. But I think it's an interesting question, and one we raised on last week's podcast about what to do with Green in the defense. But I think that's a question we can save for later.
This is fair. I also struggle seeing him come back. Maybe if there's some injuries, he could come back. If Kings were really desperate, if they really didn't want to go with Gravel or Forbert or Jamie McBain, they could bring back Matt Green. But I struggle seeing him in the lineup otherwise.
Right. So now that we've talked about fringe seventh defenseman with Derek patiently waiting, let's talk about the complete opposite, which is the top guys for each team. And I think it's, as much as everyone talks about, you know, the depth and about the sort of role players that have come in for each team, it's going to be what it always is, which is it's going to come down to Kopitar and it's going to come down to Thornton. And I was looking up the stats for a Q&A that Hint is going to go on the blogs, Jules from the Crown and Fear the Finn, tomorrow. But Thornton and Kopitar have matched up a lot more this year than they ever have before. In fact, Joe Thornton's most common opponent in the NHL for any team has been Andrei Kopitar this year. And Thornton has I think it's a 59% Corsi 4 against Kopitar this year. And obviously the Sharks have won 3 out of 5 games. So far it seems like Thornton has the upper hand. Derek, do you think there's any merit to the Thornton for Selkie and the Thornton for Hart talk this year?
Oh, absolutely. I tweeted out a couple of days ago, but Thornton ended up finishing the season with, I think it was a 70.7% goals for percentage at 5-on-5, which is, so the data, at least on war on ice, goes back to the 2005-06 season, and no forward who played at least 1,000 minutes in any of those seasons had that high of a goals for percentage ever in any of those years. It's the best season by that metric at least since 2004, but I don't have the data going back further than that, it could be even longer. Definitely some of that was favorable percentages. I think his PDO was hovering around 104 or something like that. But, I mean, he just had a – that takes away from just a phenomenal season that he had. And, I mean, you spoke to the underlying numbers. I think Peter DeBoer has definitely used his forwards differently than McClellan did. McClellan was more he was more focused on getting the matchups that he wanted, which was usually Logan Couture against Andre Kopitar, which, I don't think that was a particularly effective matchup for the Sharks. It was more or less compensated by the fact that Thornton would pretty much destroy Mike Richards, at least in the 2013 series, and the start of that 2014 series before Daryl Sutter made the adjustment to move Richards down to the fourth line and go with that 70s line as the second unit. But yeah, I mean, this year Thornton's been playing much more against opposing teams' best players, just because DeBoer has kind of rolled his lines and Thornton gets the most ice time, so he sees the other team's players who get the most ice time, and he's just done a fantastic job, and he's once again lifted Joe Pavelski to the kind of goal scoring season that I never thought we would see from Pavelski. Now 3 years in a row where he's hit 35 goals. Tomas Hertl had, I think, 4 goals on the season on like January 17th or whatever it was when he was put on Thornton's line, and then he had, I think, 18 goals the rest of the way or something along those lines. So it was a resurgence for Hertl, and Thornton is he's at 30, 36, 37. He's still just one of the best players in the NHL, and I think he deserves some sort of recognition for the season that he's had, whether that's Hart Trophy consideration or Selke Trophy or hopefully Conn Smythe Trophy consideration.
And this funny.
And the Selke consideration. Sorry, go ahead, Derek. Good.
Sorry. I was on. Yeah.
Okay. I was gonna say the Selke thing is interesting because everybody talks about how it's transitioned more from defensive center to two-way center, and Thornton, you know, he doesn't necessarily fit the defensive mold as much because he, you know, it's the same argument as the Carlson argument where he doesn't kill penalties. Thornton gets more offensive zone starts, especially compared to Kopitar, but the goals for percentage numbers are just sort of staggering, like you said. And at a point where, you know, if we went out and re-signed Milan Lucic for 7 more years, the fan base would be, you know, happy, but there would also be a ton of concern about him declining towards the end of that. And if Lucic got re-signed to a 7-year deal tomorrow, he would still be younger at the end of that than Thornton is now. So it's, I don't know if beyond Jaromir Jagr, we've seen any other players that have maintained that kind of effectiveness. And if Kopitar is that good when he's 36, then we've got an absolute steal of a contract.
Joe Thornton is excellent. He has been since before he was a Shark, really. That was always a ludicrous trade for Boston to make, as they are wont to do. I'm all for him winning the Hart Trophy this year. I am pretty sure he won't, but I'm all for it, mainly so the piece of garbage in Chicago doesn't win it, but that's probably not going to happen. Thornton actually probably deserves it, too. I think even statistically, I mean, I know Kane has a bunch of points, but I don't really buy that points make Kane a better player than Thornton is. Thornton drives play much better than Kane has for his entire career. So I would much rather see Thornton win it than Kane or pretty much anybody else in the league. I'd be okay with it. I would be okay with Thornton and Kopitar both receiving a lot of consideration for it. I don't think Kopitar will. I hope Thornton does, because I think he's one of the big keys to the keeping the Sharks afloat while Couture was out, and pretty much he's been the whole key to their success since he became a Shark. I mean, he's driven them to where they are at this point.
Yeah, and it's very possible that Thornton doesn't even get a nomination, and that that would be, you know, you've got Kane, you've got Crosby. I think Crosby's worked his way into consideration just with his second half. And, there are too many years where it's sort of just going to be one guy out west that maybe has a chance. And it's still kind of amazing in hindsight that Corey Perry managed to win a Hart Trophy. But, of course, I think he led the league in scoring that year, except maybe for Daniel Sedin, who was the runner-up. As for Selke, I think the Bruins missing the playoffs has kind of opened the door this year for Kopitar to finally win it. This sort of recent swell of support for Thornton is interesting, but I think it's too late for him to get that consideration, especially since he's not known as a defensive player.
Yeah, I would be surprised. I would be surprised if he ends up being a finalist for the award. I'm sure he'll receive some votes, but you'll see a bunch of weird people get votes. Like, I think I told a friend that Tyler Toffoli would probably get a vote because his plus-minus is among the best in the league. And Tyler Toffoli actually does probably deserve a vote somewhere at some point on somebody's ballot. He's actually been very good in pretty much every metric, but he doesn't deserve a finalist or anything like that. But he will probably get one simply for his plus-minus, not for anything else that he's done as a King.
Right. The problem for him is you go to the next name on the plus-minus list, and it's Andre Kopitar. So
that is a problem.
At that point. Well, yeah, it's a good problem. So we've talked about the forwards. The other guy that I want to talk about from San Jose especially is Brent Burns, because he has, much like Thornton, gotten a bunch of recent consideration for the award season. And for Burns, it's largely because of his point totals. But besides the scoring, have you seen any sort of difference in Burns' game this year?
Yeah, I mean, at least at the start of the year, it was sort of the same old Brent Burns, who was basically a forward playing out of position. And he was still extremely productive, but, yeah, I mean, he wasn't giving the Sharks a ton of value on the defensive side of the puck. But over the second half of the season, and I think it's a combination of a lot of different factors, maybe him just settling into being a defenseman again after a year and a half of playing forward, and then last season, which was sort of just a shit show for the Sharks all around. And then I think the second half of this season, he's really taken some big strides defensively that I never really expected him to take. He's been a lot more controlled in his own exits. He isn't just firing the puck up as soon as he sees an open guy in the neutral zone. He's cleaned up a lot of his defensive zone play. He just looks a lot calmer out there. I still wouldn't necessarily consider him for the Norris Trophy. I think a lot of the arguments that are used, in my opinion, erroneously against Erik Karlsson really do sort of legitimately apply to Burns, especially his play in the first half of the season. I do think he did have a tendency and still does sort of have a tendency to sacrifice defense for the sake of offense. But I mean, he's been much better at on the blue line than I ever thought that he would be. I mean, I was advocating as late as last season for him to be moved back up front. And at this point, I don't think I'd say that anymore. I think they did make the right decision in hindsight to put him back on defense. And he sort of proved Doug Wilson right. I know that was a point of contention between Wilson and McClellan, with Todd McClellan wanting the Sharks to use Burns as a forward and Doug Wilson disagreeing, in large part because he acquired Brent Burns explicitly for the Sharks to have as sort of a post-Dan Boyle option on the blue line, to quarterback the power play and just be that dose of offense from their defense. And I mean, that was probably one of the things that led to McClellan's departure. And instead, Burns has proved Wilson right, largely. So I think he's going to have a big impact on the series, and I think it might be more beneficial to the Sharks than to the Kings, whereas earlier in the season, if you were asking to project Burns' impact on the Sharks-Kings playoff series, I think he'd probably be giving up as much as he was producing for the Sharks. So, yeah, I think he's had an excellent season, and he deserves some recognition for that. I don't know if I'd give Norris consideration, but I mean, hopefully next season he'll continue to improve.
Would you take Vlasic or Burns if you're going forward just to pick one defenseman?
I think I'd still take Vlasic, especially since he had a surprisingly productive offensive season. I think he had 39 points in 67 games. I think he honestly had more 5-on-5 points than even Drew Doughty did this season, and he continues to be extremely good defensively. So I think Vlasic is still overall more valuable to the team. I know people would disagree with that. But I mean, it's certainly close, and obviously no one brings offense from the blue line like Burns.
I do think Vlasic is probably one of the top 10 defenders in the league in terms of two-way production, like in terms of being able to do both things. I think he's always been a little underrated offensively too. He seems to consistently be pretty high up in five on five points for 60. It's but he doesn't ever score a lot of points for some reason. Just he doesn't get a lot of power play time historically.
Yeah, he's been getting a little more second unit time. I think he's been on the first unit for part of the start of the season, although that didn't really work out. But yeah, I'd expect him to see him on the second unit throughout this series.
Okay, while we're talking about it, I'm sure you would take Carlson over Doughty. Is it closer than most people make it out to be, or do you think it's Carlson to run away?
I think it's close. I think you have to. I mean, it's not like Doughty had a nothing offensive season this year. He did have over 50 points, and although most of that came on the power play, I think you do have to give him credit for producing on a power play for the Kings that hasn't been particularly dominant throughout this era of success that they've had. But I mean, Carlson's season was just ridiculous. I mean, it was unprecedented. It's not just like Daddy didn't have an okay offensive season. He had a very good one. Carlson didn't just have a great offensive season. He had a historic, amazing offensive season that I don't think if you adjust for the context of the era, I don't think anyone has had this kind of a season in a very, very long time for the Blue Line. So I agree that at some point, maybe Doughty should be recognized for what he does year in, year out, but it's not this year. I mean, Carlson just had a ridiculous season. He should win the Norris.
That's fair.
Is your third nominee Brent Burns?
Probably not. I think Victor Hedman had sort of an under the radar, really, really good season for the Lightning. I know he was injured at the end of the year. I don't know how many games he ended up getting overall, but yeah, he had an excellent season. I think he'd be my third guy.
Chris Letang?
Yeah, Letang had a great season too. A lot of defensemen had really good seasons this year. I know Hedman's underlying numbers were really impressive. I don't know Letang's off the top of my head, to be completely honest, so it's entirely possible he had a great year too. But I don't know. I really like Hedman, and I think he doesn't get enough recognition for being one of the best defensemen in the league.
I also agree with that. I think Hedman is excellent. I think I tweeted the other day, is like, I can't wait for us to finally give Victor Hedman his Lifetime Achievement Award, Norris.
And he's, how old is Hedman? He's, what, 24? No, he's older than that, but...
he might not be.
No, 25.
He was an 09,
okay, so
he was an 09 draft pick,
right.
So I think he's like, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, 25.
Yep, 25.
But he also, Hedman, you know, in sort of a Doughty-ish situation, Hedman only had 47 points this year. So unless you
only.
Are someone only.
Good talk, guys. Good talk. Eric, are you still alive?
I am. I don't know. I echoed there for a minute, so I wanted to let it sit and see what happened.
That's good.
Yeah, good. So
I should probably take this time to admit that I spent like the 7 months that I wasn't online exclusively looking at the video of Dustin Brown kneeing Tomas Hertl like it's the Zapruder film. my conclusion is that Dustin Brown did it, which is also my conclusion coming in, so
it sounds like it was a tremendous waste of time, like hockey
yep.
in general. So that's, I guess,
exactly.
nothing gained, nothing lost.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean one of the reasons I'm confident about the Sharks in this series, or more so than I have been in playoffs past, is that I think one thing that gets really overlooked over the entire Thornton era is how bad their goaltending has been in the playoffs. And it's not even that they've had bad goaltenders necessarily. I mean, Nabokov was not as good after the 2005 lockout as he was before, but he's still a decent regular season goalie. But he was just – he had some series where he was basically awful. I mean, there was that series against the Ducks when the Sharks won the President's Trophy and lost to an 8-seed at Anaheim when he was vastly outplayed by Hiller. There was a series against the Blackhawks where the Sharks were swept and really they played well enough to at least take it to 6 or 7 games, but Nabokov was just giving up goals from the blue line. And then Niemi was more or less an average starter for the Sharks in the regular season. They just had some awful playoff runs, including the back half of that 2014 series against the Kings. I think a big part of the issue there was that they never had anyone else to turn to. I mean, they had Brian Boucher and Antero Ninomaki at the ends of their careers, and they had Alex Stalock, who really should have never been in the NHL to begin
with.
Hey,
don't forget Vesa Toskala. He was really good.
Oh, right, yeah. How could I forget Vesa Toskala?
Oh, no.
Yeah, I think this year they have that other guy in James Reimer who I hope that DeBoer doesn't hesitate to turn to if Jones struggles, and I think that's key because I tweeted this out earlier. The Sharks' playoff save percentage in the Thornton era is .908, and the average playoff save percentage over those 10 years is something like .916, .917. So that's a big part of the story of why this Sharks team has never gotten over the hump. And now that they have two good, solid, slightly above average starting goalies, I think, they can probably count on at least one of them being hot at any given time. So hopefully they're willing to switch between them if one struggles.
Hey, we have seen what a slightly above league average goaltender can do in the Stanley Cup.
And now Antti Niemi is in Dallas where he has a .905 save percentage on the year, but he's had four very good starts in a row, and now Lindy Ruff is not going to announce who will start in goal. So there is
an amazing
chance that we see Niemi.
There was an amazing quote from Kari Lehtinen today. I don't know if you guys saw it. He was asked about like his relationship with Niemi, and he was like, "Oh yeah, it's a great relationship. Someone slashed Niemi's tires. It wasn't me though." And then he just continued along with the quote as if that was like completely irrelevant. Yeah, someone slashed his tires. It definitely wasn't me. But yeah, that happened.
That is unbelievable.
No, that's good. Antti Niemi, since the All-Star break, has 15 starts and an .889 save percentage. So I hope he does start for the Stars. We can get a good team out of the playoffs. Kari Lehtinen is a star or anything. They're both pretty bad. But Antti Niemi, I hope they do start him based on four good starts. That would be a really stupid thing to do.
Dallas is paying so much money for such bad goaltending.
I will say I don't think the money matters that much. Like I talked about this with somebody earlier this year. I can't remember who it was, but like everybody spends a lot of money, and you can't make a big dent in your goaltending unless you're getting Tuukka Rask when he's really good, or Henrik Lundqvist, or someone of that ilk. Like everybody spends $6.5 million on goaltending to start. They spend $13 million or whatever it is, but that wouldn't make a big difference to them. They would spend it on probably depth, and that would make them a little better, but probably not a lot better because they actually have done pretty well with their depth players like Cody Eakin and guys like that. They could get a little more defense, but nobody really knows how to evaluate defense in the NHL anyway. I don't have faith that they would use that $6.5 million very well. So it's funny that they spend a lot. I don't think it really actually hurts them as much as other people do. But it is comical that they have two goalies that are terrible and they're going to start the worst one. That will be good.
That's totally fair. Anytime I can get a strike against the perpetual, Jim Neal and the Dallas Stars have won the offseason crowd.
That is the worst. That is terrible.
Yeah.
They're
three-time defending offseason champions at this point, and it's won them zero series.
They did. Remember, they got Sean Horkoff, who totally changed everything that one time. Jim Neal playing chess, we're all playing checkers.
Yeah, well, Jim Neal knew that Horkoff was juicing and no one else did, not even the NHL, so great, great pickup.
Smart competitive advantage.
Hey, we saw the Canadians put that to good use, trading Jared Tenorti. They knew he was on the juice. It was a really good trade for them. They got an all-star for Jared Tenorti.
Yeah, can't argue with Mark Bergevin. I know everyone in Habs country loves him.
Yeah, they're probably thrilled to have John Scott for a game. I think they should retire his number.
Derek,
yeah, add
John
it to the
Scott
long
Steelers.
List. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
I said John Scott feelings. Go.
Yeah, that was bizarre. I mean, how can you not be happy for the guy? But I think it basically nailed home the point that Mike Brown is an even worse player than John Scott, because I really don't think if Mike Brown was pity voted into the All-Star game, he would have even gotten a shot on goal with one, two goals. So that was funny to me. And then of course the Canadians claim him on waivers, which is like the highlight of the Sharks season. So
at least they have both of them now.
Yeah.
I mean, we could find out. We could have another All-Star game where we just send everybody to play against them. It'd be pretty fun. I'd watch it. I'd watch the Canadians lose games all day long. It's like
when you have the chance
game.
To follow the when you have the chance to follow the team building blueprint of the 2014-15 San Jose Sharks, you take it.
Go for, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Or if you can match, you know, the Buffalo Sabres that had John Scott, or who else? The Phoenix. Let's go with the Arizona Coyotes. They were really good. Got to get the player from the Arizona Coyotes.
Those great Leafs teams that had Mike Brown.
Yeah, those guys were good. They had like Joey Crabbe. Remember Joey Crabbe?
Oh. Nick, I think that also might be the first time you've ever brought up the Coyotes unprompted.
I bet Phoenix first. And let me be clear, they still do not exist. They're not a real hockey team at all. Under any circumstances, they are a fake hockey team. I will take that to the grave. I did call them Phoenix first. The Phoenix guys. So they're still fake. Like now, Arizona is such a garbage name. Arizona. Arizona is the worst state in the country.
We've only got
no argument there.
If you've ever driven from Las Vegas to Arizona, Las Vegas is not a particularly like progressive town. I mean, it's got, you know, the glitz and glamour of the strip. If you drive from Las Vegas to Phoenix for a game, it's like driving back in time. It's ridiculous. You get to these towns that have that are outwardly racist like billboards that are like, we need to send the Mexicans back to Mexico. It's the most horrific thing to like drive from LA to Phoenix. It is horrible. To drive from Vegas to Phoenix. It's probably even worse to drive from LA to Phoenix because LA is even more progressive than Vegas. So you drive from LA to Phoenix and it's just like driving back like 60 years. Like suddenly you're driving in one of those cars that you feel like is going to break down every 2 minutes and you have to it's like puffing smoke out of the hood and you got to get out and bang it with a wrench and then suddenly it works again.
And obviously you're in the desert this whole time, which I think really sets the mood properly.
Oh, also Phoenix is the flattest fucking city I've ever been in my life. I cannot believe it. Like you're looking off like the edge of the world. Like you can see the curvature of the earth in Phoenix because there's nothing in the way to stop you from seeing it. It's the flattest city ever. I hate Phoenix so fucking much. Oh my God.
I think that's their motto actually, flatter and more racist than Las Vegas.
It probably is. And it's actually quite a feat. It's really impressive. Actually, Vegas is not very flat, but we are pretty racist, so it's very impressive that Phoenix.
So it evens out. Yeah.
It's really impressive that Phoenix is the worst city in the Southwest. Like, there are some bad cities in the Southwest, and Phoenix is just like, you know what? We can beat that shit. Let's put a hockey team here for some reason. That makes sense.
And in Vegas, naturally.
At least we had some games here, like, in the 90s, outdoor. Like, people wanted to come here. Nobody wants to go to Phoenix unless you're a golfer. I'm a golfer, and I don't want to go to Phoenix. Phoenix sucks. I never want to go.
The last 10 minutes of this podcast have just been a joy, and I'm so glad we ended up on that somehow. Derek, are you enjoying
your
current
surroundings? Are you going to switch allegiances to the Las Vegas team, Nick? Sorry to interrupt her.
I think about it a lot. Like, there was definitely a point last season when I was really burned out on the Kings with the Slava Voynov situation, and they also had, you know, Drew Doughty has been accused of violence against women, and it was tough to watch them be what they were last season, where there was just it wasn't even quite tone deafness; it was acting like it didn't exist in some ways. Like it was. Like, they would dance around it. Like, they would, it was just in the room with them, but they were, like, staring at the wall and talking at the wall and hoping that you just wouldn't pay attention to this giant monster that was in the room. So there was definitely a point last season where I was like, you know what, I would definitely switch allegiances. Right now, I would think I would follow both teams. If I could somehow, like, get credentials to the Vegas team, like, if I could run a blog for that or something like that, I would probably go for it. If nothing else, just to go to NHL games every night, and I'd write about it and write some kind of garbage and, I don't know, make some, like, $40 a month on it. It'd be really lucrative for me, I'm sure. probably I can make enough in gas money to go to the games every month. That'd be great.
Do we think you're going to claim Vincent LeCavalier in the expansion draft after he fails to retire?
Oh, I can't wait to have Vinny LeCavalier and Dustin Brown on the Las Vegas Black Knights or whatever they're going to be. it'll be great. Like, I actually do really like Dustin Brown, but let's be clear. Like, I actually wanted to bring this up earlier. Like, you were talking about the depth of the Sharks. I'm pretty sure your third line center can't compete with Vinny LeCavalier, who's actually the greatest hockey player in the NHL. Also, has a legendary cock. Just to be clear, I've been told.
Yeah, for listeners that haven't been keeping up, I'm glad.
Yeah,
Nick,
this is a weekly thing where I have to remind everybody that I got in an argument on Twitter with a guy that insisted Vinny LeCavalier's cock was legendary. So we have that. That's really good. That's what you missed on Twitter while you were gone. You missed me arguing about Vinny LeCavalier's gigantic penis. Welcome back.
I missed so much, yes.
Why did you come back? You were free.
Yeah, I know. I regret it every day. I don't know, man. They were gonna play the Kings in the playoffs or the Ducks, and I don't know.
You live in Chicago.
It was a huge mistake. I've made a huge mistake.
I guess if you lived in San Jose, what you could do is, like, you could do, like, old-school tweeting where you go to a public bathroom and you, like, sketch, like, Drew Doughty is a dickhead on a bathroom stall and hope that somebody laughs at it, like, down the line. They could write, like, under, like, one RT, be really good. Like, I retweet this bathroom garbage.
Little hearts around it.
You have to, like, smear shit on the stall wall in order to signify a
and face. That's Dwight King, actually. That's just Dwight King right there. It's like, oh, look at this picture of Dwight King. that's a picture. Actually, you can't get a picture of Dwight King because he's invisible now. I haven't seen him ever.
What are the Kings' lines? I'm sure this is riveting to Kings fans listening to this. What are the Kings' lines heading into Game 1? So are they... Is Tanner Pearson really on the top line? I saw that somewhere. I wasn't sure about it.
Pearson's been skating with Kopitar and Lucic lately, which I'm okay with. And then you've had Carter with Toffoli, and I'm blanking on who's on the Kings roster. I don't know.
Well,
probably.
Yeah, I mean,
Chris Versteeg, somebody. I don't know.
Yeah, Versteeg was on the second or the first line with Kopitar, and actually playing fairly well. Except that Versteeg then moved down to the fourth line for the last few games with Andreoff, and you know, has actually managed to score on that fourth line along with Andreoff, who
is
continuing
their goals in our failed effort to secure the division title. Now we'll go to the playoffs. Andreoff will have four scoreless games, and the Kings will be back on the golf course by the end of next week.
Yeah, and I mean the lines today at the morning skate, whether or not they're actually relevant, it was Lucic, Kopitar, and Pearson, Brown, Carter, and Toffoli, King, LeCavalier, Versteeg, and then Clifford, Andreoff, and Lewis, with Gabrick skating on the side and Nick Shore appearing to be a scratch until the end of time. Nick Shore, who led the league in possession. I'm sure Derek knew that already, but I just wanted to make that clear. But Brown on the second line, I think, is something we haven't seen in quite some time, because he either ends up with Kopitar or he gets put on that third line where he's a weapon that, you know, doesn't really fire but looks dangerous all the time. So that's sort of what we're faced with, and Versteeg being on the third line means more time for Versteeg, which is okay. But that's where we stand.
I mean, that's a pretty solid top nine as long as Versteeg stays out of the doghouse.
That probably won't happen. I did say that my prediction was that he would get scratched at some point. Like, it'll just happen. He'll be a healthy scratch, or he'll get benched for a game because, I don't know, he scores three goals and then makes a turnover in the defensive zone with 4 minutes left in the 7-3 game. And it's like, well, he's got to be benched now. So that's
it's
probably going to be the Chris
Versteeg
saga.
Thing. Yeah.
I think Sutter and Quenneville, I think I said this last week, Sutter and Quenneville are very similar coaches in how they handle players like Versteeg. And Versteeg never quite made it out of Quenneville's club or doghouse in the last couple of years, so I wouldn't be so surprised if that happens in L.A. too. I will say Dustin Brown on the second line is a little odd. I'm torn on what I want the Kings to do. On one hand, I think Lucic, Carter, and Toffoli have been one of the best lines in the league this year statistically, so I'd like to see that. But at the same time, that leaves very little for Anže Kopitar to work with until Gabrick gets back. Even if you put Versteeg on that line and Pearson, Versteeg and Pearson are not, it's not a great first line for Kopitar. You'd like to see some more weapons with him. Lucic and Toffoli have been a really good duo this year. You could put them with Carter or Toffoli and get a really, or with Carter or Kopitar and get a really good line. Obviously, they're both good centers and those are all really good players. But so the debate, I think, for Sutter is whether he wants to split up Lucic and Toffoli or put them together, and it's probably tough right now with Gabrick out.
Yeah, and I was trying to think of how Brown and Toffoli would operate together, and so I couldn't recall them playing together. I looked it up. They played a total of 37 minutes together this season. Like, Brown has spent more time with Derek Forbert this year than he has with Tyra Toffoli. He spent more time with Michael Mersch, who was only up for, you know, a month or so. So Brown and Toffoli, I don't, you know, I think they'll be fine together, but I literally can't come up with the ways in which they're going to work together because we just haven't seen it. So I don't think that holds for too long, but maybe I'm wrong and Brown starts scoring with Carter and Toffoli drawing attention away from him.
Dustin Brown has also played more minutes with Dwight King, who is ascended from the physical form and no longer exists as a human person. He's just a puff of smoke and that's it. He just floats around the ice.
When he grins, you see light emanating from the area without any sort of physical presence behind it.
This is
true. Quite magical.
Well, at least he can't add any more victims to his murder base, you know?
He hasn't. It was pretty much Alex Petrangelo, and then Dwight King evaporated from the plane of existence. That was it. Rest in peace, Alex Petrangelo. You're stuck in St. Louis forever.
Not a great place to be.
No, it's not. At least, I think we can agree on that before, you know, we go here. At least we're not St. Louis. Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be exasperating and hilarious at the same time when they get probably by most measures the weakest Chicago team that we've had in a few years and still manage to lose in six games.
Yeah, I have full confidence that the Blackhawks are going to win that series, even though this is not the same Blackhawks team.
It'll be funny because the Blues will go up 3-0 in that series and somehow still lose it in six games. Like, the series will be tied at 3, and they'll be like, you know what, St. Louis, we're not even going to bother. You're gone now. You're done.
Ryan Miller is just going to magically appear in game 4 and just give up so many goals that it counts as 2 losses.
It'd be funny if Ryan Miller ruined the Canucks tank and also ruined the Blues playoff hopes. That'd be really...
He'd be a hero. He'd be an American hero again.
It would be great. Like, it would be great. It would be the best thing that could happen, I think. I want it to happen.
Oh, absolutely. Derek, as Nick mentioned, we are winding down a bit here, but before we get to sort of predictions, I'm just curious, what is the vibe like with Chicago this year? Are the fans sort of sensing that this is a different team?
I bet they are.
I mean, the smart ones are, but that's a very small subset of the massive, massive
three?
Blackhawks bandwagon fan
three
base.
Of them?
So most
Two?
Most people just, pretty much 1.5 on a good day. But I mean, most people blindly think this is as every bit as good a Blackhawks team as the last 3 or 4 or 5 or however long it's been since Case and Kane appeared. I don't sense any different feeling. I think people are really excited about the series with the Blues, and I mean, they have every right to be. It is the Blues. I just don't think beyond that series, I can't see them going much farther. But then I look at the bracket, and I don't know. I'd probably pick them against Dallas too. So I feel like they have a pretty clear path to the Western Conference Final if they can even play half decent hockey. But they haven't really even done that for most of the season.
I really would like to see them get to the Western Conference Final if the Kings can get there. If the Kings can't get to the Western Conference Final, then fuck Chicago. Like, I just really want to beat Chicago in the playoffs. I really want it as a Kings fan. I pretty much always want it, but I really want it this year. I'd love to beat them and take, you know, the 2-1 series lead in this Chicago-LA era of Western Conference hockey. It'd be great to me.
Although it looks like Quenville's gone like full meathead, and he's got Brandon Mashiner, or Brandon Manshiner, as we used to call him in San Jose, on the third line for game one. So good luck with that.
Just real quick, we do have two guys wondering if we're taking calls. Are we taking live callers?
Let me.
We now have three guys because Andrew Leafman is trolling us.
Oh God!
Oh no. we do have a caller on hold.
Isn't it past his bedtime? Go to bed, Andrew.
He's way too young to be up this late. It's
way too past your bedtime. Yeah.
Even if he's back on the West Coast, it's 8 o'clock, and it's like it's 2 hours past your bedtime, kiddo. You gotta go to sleep.
So yeah, we do have 15 minutes. We'll go ahead and take the call. So I see one caller on hold right now. So
let's hope for the best.
All right, 805. You are on the air.
Hey guys, this is Phil. You guys probably know me as Puddle. I figured I'd call in and help prevent Nick from getting in his car and murdering everybody in Phoenix, or distracting Eric from talking about Vinny Letavalier's penis anymore. So yeah, I thought I'd give you guys a
chance. We could talk about that some more. It's legendary.
You could. We could. But you know, you guys are winding down, and I thought I'd give you a segue question to prediction. So how's that sound?
Please.
Okay, cool. So one of the interesting things that I was looking at this series, and I'd love to hear Derek's thoughts on this especially, but one of the interesting things about this series is that each team sort of has that clear advantage over the other in like the quote-unquote advanced stat. So for the Sharks, it's the scoring chances and high danger scoring chances for percentage, which they've really dominated since I think it's like the end of January. And then for the Kings, it's like the more traditional score-adjusted course defense with stuff. So I guess if you had to pick one that you want your team to be dominant in, which would you pick and which is more predictive, and what do you think that spells for the series?
Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't seen the data necessarily on score-adjusted Corsi or anything, and I've been sort of out of the advanced stats game for a little while now. But, I mean, it looks like score-adjusted Fenwick is the measure that most people seem to be pointing at as more predictive, at least in, like, the traditional stats. So I would guess that it's probably good to have a decent score-adjusted Fenwick in your last 25 to 30 games heading into the playoffs. And I think the Sharks' numbers are skewed a little bit by not having Vlasic for about half of that time, and Vlasic, after Joe Thornton, is arguably the Sharks' most important possession player. So I'm pretty confident that that 54% or 55%, whatever it is, that the Sharks have in terms of scoring just generally in their last 25 games would be a little closer to the Kings' 57-ish percent if they had Vlasic. But yeah, I mean, the Sharks this year have been a very good shot-blocking team, and I don't mean that in the sense that they've necessarily blocked a lot of shots, but they've blocked a pretty formidable percentage of the shot attempts that they've faced. So they've been, like, truly effective at blocking shots, and that's sort of skewed their Corsi percentage a bit, whereas their Fenwick is pretty good, and their scoring chance numbers that you were talking about are pretty good. So, yeah, I mean, I think overall that we know the story with these two teams. The Kings are the better possession team. The Sharks are maybe on even footing in terms of generating actual scoring chances. But it's pretty close, I think, especially if you look at the last 25, 30 games.
Yeah, sorry, Nick, you first.
If I had to pick one, I would probably still go with possession. Just scoring chances are still cutting the sample a little bit. Even if they're reliable, perfectly reliable, which if you're tracking scoring chances with an automatic thing, they're not 100% reliable. It's pretty good, and it's measuring the same for everybody. But I would still say cutting the sample a little bit like you do for scoring chances, and especially high danger scoring chances, you're adding a bunch of noise to the stats. So if you're looking at stats, like from a pure statistic standpoint, I would still go with Fenwick and Corsi and having pure possession. But I think we would all agree that San Jose is, and probably most of the very good teams left in the NHL, except for St. Louis maybe, are better at creating offense than the Kings are.
Yeah, and the, you know, just adding or at least giving some context there, the Sharks' current high dangerous scoring chance percentage is in the 57.5% range, which is far and away the best in the NHL. Better than Pittsburgh, better than Dallas, better than those, you know, quote-unquote dangerous teams. So there is something to that, absolutely, and it bears out better for the Sharks than their actual possession numbers do. Phil, thanks for the question. Good to hear from you. We'll hope that the Kings can steal some of the scoring chances away.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Okay, so we are down to 10.5 minutes left before we get rudely cut off. We already sort of went over the Central a little bit and how there are, I guess, four sort of flawed teams coming from there. From the East, Derek
Pittsburgh.
And Nick, who do you think is going to make
Pittsburgh.
I still have, I don't know, I've got faith in Washington. I know they're not really the sexy pick because they're, or at least they're not the sexy pick in sort of like the advanced stats community or whatever because their underlying numbers haven't been great this year. I just look at their roster almost on paper and also obviously in what they've actually accomplished on the ice, and they look really, really good. Like, this looks like the best Washington Capitals team I've ever seen, and there have been some really, really good ones before, even some ones that have had better underlying numbers. But I think the Capitals come out of it this year. I think they've got another level to reach in the playoffs in terms of their possession game. But when you've got Ovechkin, Backstrom, Kuznetsov, and Williams all in your top six, and you've got really good complementary players on top of that, solid defense, Braden Holtby. It's tough to pick against them. I think if I had to pick a team to go to beat them, it would be the Penguins, but the uncertainty with their goaltending and whether or not for when Yevgeny Malkin's coming back and how the lines will look once he's in the lineup, I don't know. I still lean towards the Capitals.
I think that's really fair. Like, Washington's excellent. I do think their underlying numbers underrate them a little bit. For sure. I think it is Washington or Pittsburgh. And I am operating under the assumption that when Pittsburgh and Washington meet up eventually that they will have Malkin back and that they will have either Murray or Fleury in net, which is great. Like, Murray and Fleury, it just rhymes. I love it. It's really good. It's really important to note that, by the way.
Right. We've never had rhyming goalies. So the other thing with the Penguins, I think, in the
wait, really, really quick. That's not entirely true because we had Quick and then we had Joner, which is pretty much slang for dick. So,
you made me momentarily speechless. I can't even believe you came up with that. So, yeah, good work. Now, Zatkoff, unfortunately, isn't even close to Fleury and Murray, and more importantly, Zatkoff is a former King third stringer.
He is close to dick. This is true. I've made several Zatkoff Jackoff jokes, so.
Yep.
So that's good. I hope we get a Jones Zatkoff meeting, a Joner Jackoff meeting. That would be
Joner Zatkoff, yeah.
That would be the best.
Did we never face Zatkoff, right?
I think we did once.
Did we once? Yeah.
I don't know. Who cares about Jeff Zatkoff? He's horrible.
Wasn't he in the Kings organization at one point?
Who cares?
Yeah.
The Kings
yes.
have brought up yeah. every goalie and every part of their roster is from their minor league teams, and Jeff Zatkoff couldn't make it. So on a team where Andy Andreoff has managed to pull like 70 or 60 games this year and Dwight King is somehow carved out like an actual legitimate NHL career and Jordan Nolan has like a 500 year contract. Jeff Zatkoff was like, this is not the team for me. I'm going elsewhere because I'm not good enough.
He lost to the Joner. So what can you say?
I mean, it's fair.
So that's the Penguin situation, and of course they're going up against the Rangers and Henrik Lundqvist, which is sort of the opposite in terms of goaltending stability in the first round. So that's the East. We don't need to spend more time on them because really what's important is the Pacific. So Kings Sharks, let's make some picks. Derek, what do you think?
Well, I mean, the Sharks have been, they've been good on the road all year. They've been good at Staples Center specifically. So I'm going to say that they go into Staples Center in Game 7 and they take the series there.
I have really struggled with this series. I've talked about it a little bit. I do fear how motivated I would be if I were a San Jose Shark. Like, I would really want this series just for retribution for 2014. It would be, like, all I want, and I would really want to destroy the Kings badly. Badder than bad. Like, if the Kings are at 100% motivation, the Sharks are somehow managing to beat that. Like, they're doing the literal impossible in how much they probably want to win this series. So they do intimidate me a little bit from that standpoint. On the other hand, they're still the Sharks. I'm sure there's probably still some lingering tough memories for them that are probably equally balancing out however motivated they are. It's a really good series. I'll take the Kings because I'm a Kings fan. I think it's going to be probably a 7-game series.
Yeah, I'm making the same sort of obvious pick there, and I think it's the Kings absolutely hanging on for dear life in the third period of Game 7 with the Sharks getting 20 shots on them and Quick doing his you know, playoff Quick thing. The Ducks, do you think that whichever team comes out of this series potentially loses to the Ducks?
No, I think both teams would beat the Ducks.
Yeah,
it'll be a really, really legitimately great series. Whoever plays the Ducks, it'll be probably the best series of the playoffs. It'll be better than the King Shark series, but I think they'll both beat the Ducks.
Do either of you think the Predators have any chance in that series, or no?
No. I don't. I think Rene is just, and I guess he's been better, but no, I think the Ducks win it in like 5 games.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I could almost convince myself that if Rene somehow channels like his 2010 to 2013 self or whatever it was, that the Predators might have a chance. But yeah, I mean, I'm picking the Ducks.
And I wish I was as confident as Nick on this one, but I do not want to face the Ducks at all. I don't know if the Ducks beat the Kings, but I think the Kings are playing 7 games of their best hockey to beat the Ducks. And I think the Ducks are probably tougher than whoever they face in the conference finals and the finals.
I know we're all biased here, but I think whoever wins the Pacific probably wins the Stanley Cup. Even if the Predators made it off, I would probably take them to go all the way. I think the Predators got screwed over with the toughest route to the final.
This ended up being just like a brutal division after being like the laughingstock of the league for most of the season, with like Arizona and Vancouver in playoff spots in December or whatever it was. I mean, this is definitely the toughest grouping of the four, I think.
And Minnesota, with whatever 89 points they got, have a much easier road than Nashville.
I will say Minnesota is going to lose to that first series in 4 or 5 games. They're going to get smoked.
Unless Niemi pulls a playoff Niemi.
I think even if he does, like, even with Niemi really, like, he struggled that whole series against the Kings, and they still had a 3-0 series lead, and the Kings are a lot better than Minnesota, so.
Yeah, it's fair.
I remember noting that in that series. Like, I was like, you know, the Kings are down 3-0, but if they could just, like, even start generating scoring chances, like, all of the goals Niemi was allowing were from, like, 150 feet away. They were horrible goals. They were shots from the boards that were unscreened, and he would just, like swat at it, and it would go in. It was the most horrific goaltending performance. It was, like, not surprising at all that he ended up getting eventually pulled from that series for a game.
I think he had, like, an 800 save percentage in Game 4, where the Sharks legitimately probably played well enough to win that series that night. And I mean, the Kings had like a 20% shooting percentage on him, so that was
I do remember that. I remember thinking, like, even after Game 4, I wasn't convinced of any kind of comeback. I mean, obviously the Kings are still down 3-1, but I was like, the Kings definitely got beat in Game 4, and they were maybe on equal footing in Game 3. They hadn't really played a good game in that series yet, and then they finally did start to play a good game, and San Jose definitely faltered in the last, at least 2 of the last 3 games down the stretch.
So we've got 1 minute left. I think we'll go ahead and call it at this point. So, Derek, thanks again for joining us today and for reliving the past few months of the Sharks. And it'll be a good series, I think, either way. So thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Real quick before you go, what food item does Tyler Toffoli remind you of?
Probably like a donut hole.
That's fair. I could see it. I mean, it's not a good nickname. Like, Cupcake's a good nickname, but donut hole, not quite as much.
Yeah.
But it does kind of go with his name better, like Donut Hole Toffoli. It's like he could be...
Toffoli.
Yeah, there you go.
Toffoli, that's absolutely perfect.
But, you know...
All right.
It's good. Is he cute? Like, he's really cute. Like, him and Hurdle together, that's really cute.
He's adorable.
Lining up next to each other, it'd be like two adorable large adult sons.
All right, that's it. We've got 5 seconds. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Video Kelly's penis.